You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On Sunday, August 16th, the International Feminist Organization Women's Human Rights Campaign, WHRC, launched their United States chapter. WHRC is an international group of women dedicated to protecting the human rights of women and girls, and specifically opposing the replacement of the category of sex with that of gender identity. The organization for some time now has been gathering signatures on its public decree, which is called the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, which was developed to petition governments to reaffirm and reinstate sex-based protections for women and girls. Dr. Catherine Acosta is a recent co-chair of the Interim Steering Committee for WHRC USA, and Lauren Levy is a veteran women's rights activist and also a recent member of the Interim Steering Committee. I spoke to them recently about the Women's Human Rights Campaign, about the Declaration, and how all this applies specifically to the USA and specifically with regard to the Equality Act. Here's that interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about this today. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to be here. Yeah, we're very glad to be here.
I want to start actually by, I wonder if you both could just tell me a little bit about yourselves, your background in feminist activism, and how and why you came to get involved in this project, the Women's Human Rights Campaign in the U.S. Maybe Catherine, you can start.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, gosh, I've been a feminist as long as I can remember. I didn't go to college until my 30s and grad school in my 40s, but I did do, I did one of my degrees is in women's studies, back when it was women's studies, not gender studies. Mm-hmm. And I taught women's studies classes for a number of years. This would have been in the late 90s, early 2000s is when I was teaching at university. And so I've been interested in these issues for a very long time. And but I was trying to figure out some way to get involved when I really got this on my radar, the whole transgender thing, but I couldn't really figure it out. And then when the Women's Human Rights Campaign came along, what I really love about it is that we have a written document and that it draws on international conventions and law and longstanding international conventions and law, and it sets out very, very clearly what the rights of women should be. And so here's a coherent thing to work around, because otherwise you're just sort of flinging yourself into the fray all alone, as you have done, my dear, and you really get attacked. And my thought always was, go with a group and go with a strategy. The country contact had the signatories on the declaration and sent out an email. And I really wanted to be involved because, as I say, here it is, a group with a written document and we have something to work from.
And was there something that happened specifically that made you feel that it was really urgent or important to get involved with women's rights, specifically with regard to gender identity ideology and legislation?
Well, I think that came over like a long period of time. You know, originally, I don't know if I want to go into how it actually came onto my radar. But when it came onto my radar, then I suddenly went, okay, I didn't realize that most of these men who identify as women don't actually have the surgery. And I didn't realize there's a whole set of components to it that I didn't realize. And once I really fell down the rabbit hole, then I was interested. But I guess I was just waiting for something to come along. I wasn't sure which thing, you know, there's so many things going on in the U.S. You don't really know which direction to go. Mm-hmm. And so I, like I said, this is a coherent mission and strategy with a written document that we can work from. And I like that about this group.
Mm-hmm. And Lauren, same thing. Tell me a bit about yourself, your background, how you came to get involved.
Sure. Well, my women's liberation roots go back to the late 1960s when I was an undergraduate in college. I was at Bennington College, where Andrea Dworkin was one class ahead of me, and where we all made sure that any student who needed an abortion got a safe one. This was before Roe v. Wade, of course. And then a little later in the 70s, I was on the Dartmouth faculty at the time when they first admitted women as undergraduates. And there was a women's center in the town also that I became involved in. I mean, I think when I think back on it, I don't think I slept at all, but I was young, so I guess I didn't need any sleep. So we did, somebody got a mimeographed sheet of consciousness raising materials from New York City. And we started consciousness raising groups in this women's center on Main Street in Hanover, New Hampshire. I loved that. I mean, it was just amazing. It changed people's lives in an incredibly short time. It was brilliant. It was just amazing stuff. So I became very much involved in that and led the consciousness raising groups. And then in the 1980s, I was one of the founding members of the Sirens Women's Motorcycle Club in New York City, which the New York Times called Dykes on Bikes. But anyway, it was the Sirens who led New York City Pride March for many years. So I was involved with the LGB movement for a while. And in the 90s, I was on the board of directors of a large LGB center in Westchester County in New York. And it was a very interesting time because I was there when T wanted to join LGB. Mm-hmm. There were most, I would say, slightly more than half the lesbians who were active at the center opposed it. It was really the gay men who wanted T, they wanted P, meaning pedophile, and they wanted SM. And they wanted to add all of those letters and all of those constituencies. And lesbians, I would say most of the lesbians, but not all, resisted mightily because we didn't want that in our, I mean, we understood right away that it meant that lesbian rap groups were going to have men in them. I mean, and maybe straight men who were into S&M, and some of us were trauma survivors, right? So it didn't sit well. So we fought back hard. And in fact, we won on the P and the SM, but we lost on the T. And I didn't know at the time that this was going on globally. I've heard so many people from so many different places say that this was, tell stories that are kind of parallel to mine. And then last January, I worked with Wolf on an event in New York City called Canceled Women, of which you were one. Mm-hmm. So I met you very briefly there. And then as Catherine said, I was contacted as one of the signatories to the declaration. And I was really ready. I was really looking for a way to become involved in this fight. Mm-hmm. It just seemed it seemed perfect.
Why do you think, why was it that it was specifically gay men who wanted to bring these extra letters into the gay rights movement? Not just the T, but the P, the S&M.
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that it's there's something about male sexuality, and I'm not an expert on male sexuality, but I kind of think there's something about male sexuality that embraces I'm going to call them fetishes, whereas women maybe not so much. I really don't know. I'm not an expert on it at all, but that's my...
Statistically, that is true, that men are more likely to... Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know either. And it just is interesting that you said that, because I just finished doing an interview earlier today with a sex researcher, not for Feminist Current, for my other channel. And he's done research on pedophilia and on fetishes and kinks, whatever you want to call them. And I sort of asked the same, I was like, why is it that it's almost all men, you know? Like, he even said it's a total rarity, you know, you're going to write a paper on it if you find a woman who's a pedophile, or even right. who has one of these, he called them atypical sexualities, but, you know, fetishes and things like that. And I was like, why is that? And I don't think even they really know. They obviously, they're sex researchers and scientists, so they look at brains. So they sort of, they will look and see, you know, is there something that happened in the brain, like in utero or something like that, that, you know, made this person, I don't know, function in this particular way. And they have found stuff to do with pedophilia, but still, to me, I sort of, you know, you wonder how much is nature versus nurture. And I'm sure there's probably a mix of the two that maybe we're yeah. never going to totally understand.
Well, I was thinking maybe that it has to do with how comfortable men are with patriarchy as opposed to women, and with gender. I mean, you know, a lot of gay men really love gender. They play with gender. They love drag queens, right? It's a whole integrated part of gay male cultures, drag queens. And women, you know, gender is a problem. Gender is our problem as women, right? So maybe part of it is nurture.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I doubt we're going to figure it out right now, but it is an interesting question. And, you know, and it also that conversation with him, it tied into the autogynephilia thing, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, why is it that some men, you know, if you're familiar with the research around this, in terms of males who transition, if they transition fairly young, usually those men are actually gay men. And the ones who transition later in life, you know, 40, 50, even 60 years old, those are men. Those are autogynephiles. And anyway, I'm not a sex researcher, so I can't go around referencing that research specifically with the kind of knowledge that the people who did it did. But I mean, I guess, would you say that time was when there was a split between lesbians and lesbian interests and the interests of gay men?
I can't. It was more complicated than that, because there was a split among lesbians. In fact, I think that there was a split among lesbians between, which is really interests me more, between lesbians who centered women in the way that they saw the world, and women who centered men, and the lesbians who centered men in the way they saw the world. I mean, that seemed to be the split that was occurring in the lesbian community.
Okay. And I mean, I guess I wonder, what year was that, by the way? What year are we talking about?
I was trying to remember. It was, I think, around 1996, something
okay.
like that.
So is that when you see this whole trans activism, transgender identity concept starting to really take hold?
Yes, there were just a couple of transgender activists, and they spoke in jargon, so I never understood what they were talking about, really, except that I knew I didn't want to be around them. And I didn't want them in my lesbian rap groups, and I didn't, you know, they were, I would say, much less aggressive than they are currently. They were looking for acceptance, and they were presenting as harmless, really. But yes, I certainly there was transgender ideology that was the first time I became aware of something that I would still recognize as transgender ideology.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have any theories about why things started really amping up and, you know, gender identity legislation started being passed, all these policies started changing in schools, prisons, et cetera, sports. I mean, within the past decade, I suppose.
I don't know, Catherine, you got any ideas?
Oh my gosh, I was sitting here enjoying the conversation. So much. I'm like, wow, I can't wait to hear what she says next. Any theories about why it exploded? I'm not sure, but I think there's a lot of money behind it. And there's also, you know, as Jennifer Billick has written about very, very well. And then there's that whole transhumanism thing. I think, too, probably they picked up a lot of the jargon of the various activist movement, the civil rights movements, you know, whether it was the women's movement, whether it's black feminist theory and all of those kinds of things. They grabbed onto a lot of stuff that they could use. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't really say, you know, why it came about like that.
So I was wondering if there was
No, go ahead.
I was just wondering if there was a long-term plan, and maybe finally, within the last few years, all of the ducks were in a row. There had been enough capture of institutions and enough capture of policies in enough places in the world that they felt secure about becoming suddenly much more aggressive.
You know, that's really interesting, too, because where was I reading that they said, I wish I could remember the article. It was intentional to fly under the radar to do a lot of this policy capture, to do a lot of institutional capture. But they intentionally flew under the radar for a very long time and then sort of exploded and caught everybody kind of by surprise.
That's how it looked to me.
I think I did read an article by a UK journalist. I wish I could remember his name. I feel bad that I can't because I'd like to credit him. But I remember there was an article semi-recently by a UK journalist who talked about that, about how they sort of worked on policy and worked on people, you know, people who had the power to affect these kinds of changes behind the scenes for a long time before they were sort of ready to go public and go big and pounce, as it were, if you want to frame it like that. But anyway, I wonder if you both can talk a little bit about what's going on in the US in terms of gender identity legislation and policy. I mean, it probably varies state to state, which if that's true is a bit different than how things might work in other countries, including Canada. In Canada, it's pretty much the same all across the board within all the provinces. The policy kind of all changed around the same time. People did it without, I mean, legislators, politicians, etc., institutions, organizations, shelters, so on and so forth. They did it without consulting anyone. The little pushback that there was in Canada was ignored by the media and the politicians and the legislators. What's happening in the U.S.?
The Equality Act.
I was going to say that's the big one right now. There's a lot going on, but the big overarching thing is the Equality Act, because the Equality Act is intended to amend the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And the idea here is that now, you know, even now we're going to extend the ban on discrimination to sexual orientation and people with transgender identity. And so this bill was passed in the House last year. I think it was May of last year. Joe Biden has said that it would be something that he would want to get passed in the first 100 days of his presidency. But basically the problem... Lauren is working on quite a bit of that, about the problem with the Equality Act. But basically the problem is, rather than setting out a new protected category for sexual orientation and for transgender identity, they're trying to like fold it all into the category of sex. But Lauren can tell you more about that.
Yeah, as Catherine said, the Equality Act amends existing civil rights legislation. And the existing civil rights legislation is really pretty good, but it dates back to 1964. And so there are three classes of changes that that the Equality Act is trying to make. One is it wants to add to the classes that can that need special protection because they're discriminated against. Right, so we have classes of age, religion, sex, race, color, national origin, and disability.
Are those categories all currently included in the Equality Act?
Yes, they have been included in the existing legislation, and they are carried on into the Equality Act. However, sex is not carried over as it is. Sex is redefined, and I can talk about that more. But let me just. So it's adding sexual orientation and so-called gender identity to the protected classes. I have no problem at all with adding sexual orientation. It should be at the federal level. Gender identity, we can talk about what is actually going on here. So the second thing that it's doing, besides, you know, first thing is adding those two protected categories. The second thing it's doing is it expands the class of public accommodations that are prohibited from discriminating. And that's really important. It's important to stay up to date on that. And you really do want more than just employment and housing covered. You want, you know, all kinds of services to be covered by, you know, not being able to discriminate on the basis of these categories. Okay, so that's all good, or mostly good. Then we come to the definitions, and the definitions are terrible. They're disaster. The definitions are disastrous. First, okay, let me just go through them. They're either circular or they're just nonsensical. I'll give you some examples. Gender identity is, which is new, right? So it needs a new definition. Gender identity is the gender-related identity, great, right? Gender-related identity, appearance, mannerisms, or other gender-related characteristics of an individual, regardless of the individual's designated sex at birth. Okay, there's a lot to unpack in just a few words there. For one thing, I mean, it's a ridiculous, you know, I don't blame them for having a ridiculous definition of gender identity because it really can't be defined. It's complete. But then they make it regardless of the individual's designated sex at birth, which does two things. One is it gives it priority. It gives gender identity priority over sex.
Right.
Gender identity is the important thing. Sex.
Right. Where there's a clash between those two, the priority is to gender identity.
That's right. And then the other thing it does is designated sex at birth. What the hell is that? Sex isn't designated at birth.
Anyway. Yeah, the sex designated at birth thing that trans activists have, you know, gotten in the habit of saying and sort of forced a lot of other, you know, so-called progressives to say is interesting because they obviously stole that from, you know, intersex activists who would have in the past worked to stop doctors from deciding that babies who are born intersex should be one sex or the other, which is not common practice anymore, of course. And I think that's really where people get confused, because when you respond to people who say, you know, like assigned female at birth or assigned male at birth, and you say you're not assigned sex at birth, sex is observed, they start talking about intersex.
Right. So that's gender identity, which is a mess, and it just needs to be treated differently. And I'll get to that too if we have time. They define sex. Well, they talk about sex. So sex, I'm just sort of condensing this, but it's what it says. Sex includes a sex stereotype, sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics. All of that is sex.
You know what really blows my mind about this, Lauren, and I was saying this, I did an interview with Kara Dansky this morning, is that the thing that I really loved about when I first had to start dealing with law and contract in my own work, you know, when I was doing my film and everything, is that in any kind of legal document, at the beginning of the document, they define everything. I love that everything's defined. Producers mm-hmm. shall mean this. Educational distribution rights shall mean this, and so on. But when you get to anything that has to do with gender identity, it is so incredibly garbled. You just sit there and go, how is this even a legal document?
That's I would think it would be embarrassing.
They have no embarrassment. They have no shame.
Guess not. And then they go on to define sex discrimination in a way that's basically okay, but there's an interesting problem with it too. So sex discrimination is discrimination based on sex, a little circular, but still, orientation, gender identity, pregnancy, childbirth, and sex-based stereotypes. So the interesting thing to me is that both gender identity and sex-based stereotypes are included. And that gives me an idea about maybe how to fix this document. And they both shouldn't, gender identity shouldn't be in there because it's a ridiculous concept and because they haven't defined it. But sex-based stereotypes really should be in this document. That should be a protected class, it seems to me, along with sexual orientation. That would make it a good bill, and it would protect women and men too. It would protect lesbians or other women who are not conforming to the sexual stereotype, not gender appropriate.
Right. I mean, that's sort of one question that I and I think many others often might ask is like, I mean, I agree with you. The concept of gender identity doesn't make any sense to me. It's not. No one can define it in a cohesive way because I don't think it's a coherent concept. Like it's, you know, right. There can't be a concrete definition of something that is just an announcement or a feeling and that is intangible, which is essentially gender identity is just a feeling. You know, maybe you feel like you don't fit in your body, or maybe you feel like you don't fit within these gender stereotypes. But I mean, people will say, you know, like, can't gender identity protections exist alongside women's rights? You know, can't we protect trans identified people and also protect women's rights? I mean, what do you think about that? Is there an answer to that question?
Yes, I think that we can. I think there's a this bill can be repaired. And I think the way it needs to be repaired is by just dropping gender identity, which you know, as you point out, it's unverifiable. So it doesn't belong. It doesn't deserve legal protection.
Right. The bill doesn't require any kind of anybody to any kind of independent. Okay, this person has a gender dysphoria or anything like that. There's no requirement beyond somebody asserting, I am a woman.
But on the other hand, sex-based stereotypes is a thing, and that's verifiable. Right. That has a material reality that exists. And that deserves protection. And in fact, it has been given protection, although not in federal legislation, but it has been given partial protection in an often cited Supreme Court decision from 1989 called Price Waterhouse against Hopkins, right. which basically protects unprotected and unfeminine woman, a woman who presented in a way that her employer deemed not sufficiently feminine. This is good case law, and it should be codified into federal legislation. It stands for the notion that this not sufficiently feminine woman cannot be discriminated against by her employer because of that basis. And that should be extended to all of the categories that the Equality Act addresses. I shouldn't be able to be excluded from any anything on that basis. And if we do that, if we protect sex-based, you know, people who are unfeminine women or insufficiently masculine men, then we've given transgender identified people equal civil rights. We've given them civil rights that are equal to everybody else. We've eliminated those discriminations, and I think that's one way that we fix this this legislation. And the other thing that we need to do is to, you know, is to just keep the definitions that we've had since 1964 at least, so that you know, sex is a thing, and this weirdness, gender identity, doesn't have any priority over it. In fact, it disappears from the document. And we have two more rights. We have sexual orientation, two more protected groups, right? Sexual orientation and something like non-conforming gender.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we have, this is one of our big three projects we're undertaking now, is one is to write our own amendment to the Equality Act, and actually Lauren is spearheading that. She is going to be working on our own amendment, and that's one of the projects we have three big projects going forward right now, and that's one of them. Mm-hmm. So that we will have something, you know, when we go to the legislators, we are not just saying, no, don't do this. We said, here is the way to do it to protect everybody.
Okay. This might sound like a silly question, but what is a woman's right? You know, what is it that we are looking to protect when we're talking about sex-based rights? What does that look like in real life?
Well, we have this wonderful document called the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights.
Right.
And it's
convenient.
And it has 9 articles, and each article describes a different right than sex-based right. I could tell you what those 9 are if you would like to.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, for people who haven't read the Declaration.
Sure. And it's really solid. It should be solid law. It's based on CEDAW, which is a United Nations document.
Convention to Eradicate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women.
Yeah, right.
So the Declaration, what I want to say, I'll interrupt you just for a second, Lauren, is that the Declaration is grounded in international treaty and convention. The CEDAW and also the Convention to Eliminate Violence Against Women, I think it's called, which comes from the 1990s. So the Declaration is grounded in law, I mean in international conventions and treaties that are longstanding. We're trying to recover, or we're trying to defend ground that we already won several decades ago.
Yep. So Article 1 states that women's rights are based on sex. And CEDAW actually defines sex as the biological differences between males and females. So that's a great definition. And it's grounded in material reality, and it's established law. So so Article 1 also includes lesbian rights, which are also based on sex, based on biological differences. Article 2 is concerned with motherhood, and it states that motherhood is exclusively a female status. And for a male to claim female status constitutes sex discrimination. Article 3 covers women's right to physical and reproductive integrity, which includes full reproductive rights, no forced pregnancies, also no surrogacy. And also it describes any research that seeks to permit men to bear children. It states that constitutes sex discrimination against women as well. Then the fourth article, Article 4, is a really important one, free speech and expression, as you well know, Megan. and the, right? So that's also based on a United Nations General Assembly resolution. This one dates from 1966, called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And so the declaration states that you have the right to hold and express opinions without harassment, prosecution, or punishment, the right to receive information through any medium about anything without harassment, prosecution, or punishment, and the right to describe others on the basis of sex rather than gender identity. So misgendering is not to be prosecuted or sanctioned or punished. So that's a big one. And then there are, Article 5 is about free assembly and association. You should be able to exclude males. Article 6 is equal access for women to political participation, from equal right to vote to equal right to hold any political office. Article 7 covers sports, equal right to participate fairly and safely in sports, which includes the right not to compete against males. Article 8 is concerned with violence against women, and the right to protected spaces, the single-sex facilities that will support the right to be free of sex-based violence.
And calls for statistics to be kept on violence on the basis of sex.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's the last one.
Yep. And the last article, Article 9, is concerned with the rights of children, so that it basically protects the healthy bodies of children, and the right not to be, not to be sent through puberty blockers and then wrong sex hormones and then mutilating surgery when their bodies are perfectly healthy.
Mm-hmm. I want to interject here, if you don't mind, that involves the second project that I wanted to talk about that we're embarking on now. And that is, we're doing a whole video series where we have one video on each article of the declaration. And I recorded the first one today on Article 1. But each article, we'll have a video on our YouTube channel on each article where we talk, and we're keeping these fairly short so that people can have a chance to look at them and share them and everything and not have to do a huge time commitment. But we'll look at the article. We connect it to some real-time policy. So, for example, today I talked to Kara Dansky about the importance of sex as a discrete category in law and public policy. And then we talked about the Equality Act. And then the third piece of it is action, the action piece. And she has really good advice on how to approach your legislators. So for each article, that's what I'm doing. We're going to talk about the article. We're going to talk about a specific public policy or law that's going on right now that's being fought, and then connected also to what kind of activism can you do in that area.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple areas that I just wanted to pick up on in terms of the articles, and one of which is Article 5, so reaffirming women's right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit here, just because I can anticipate what questions come up around these kinds of issues. And, you know, so I wonder, like, some people would probably argue, well, then I guess men have the right to exclude women. Is that okay? You know, is it just women that have the right to exclude men? Does it go in any direction? Anybody has the right to assemble with those they wish and exclude those they wish. You know, could that sort of, that argument come back to bite women in the ass, as it were?
You're right. You're right. There's I think it has to be very carefully drawn. There were some cases back in the early 1970s, as I recall, that were concerned with men's clubs, exclusive men's clubs, where business deals, in fact, were made and
right.
business networking took place, right? And women were systematically excluded from being able to take part in those business deals that were made in the men's club clubs. So probably a distinction has to be made between, on the basis of what the purpose of the assembly is. I mean, women certainly have a right to meet together in order to organize their sex-based rights. They shouldn't have to have men present to talk about what it means to be a woman.
Mm-hmm. And the distinction has to be around power differentials and access to resources and networking and so on. As Lauren said, those cases where women demanded to be part of things that men were keeping them out of, were keeping them out of ways to advance their livelihoods and so on and so forth. Whereas with women, when we want to meet on our own, we are trying to talk about how to fight against our own oppression. And so that's the big difference, is which group, you know, is monopolizing resources and networking and all that kind of thing that makes it harder for the disadvantages women, perhaps in the economic sphere, or, you know, which groups are getting together to say we need to talk about what's going on with our oppression. It's ridiculous. You know, no one would say that white people are entitled to be in black people's groups when they're organizing to figure out what they want to do about their civil rights issues. You know, you wouldn't say, well, no, that's discriminatory because you didn't include whites. It's an issue of power, mm-hmm. is what it is.
Right. So we're differentiating between same-sex spaces like change rooms or washrooms or transition houses, like spaces where women might be, women and girls might be vulnerable to male violence, versus in terms of freedom, the freedom of assembly article, we're talking about political organizing and political spaces, maybe?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know of any political space where women dominate and men, and they're keeping men out. I don't know of any space like that. Do you, Lauren?
Not at all. Although at that LGB center in the 90s, the gay men often thought that the lesbians were plotting against them, but actually.
Men always think that if women get together, they're plotting against them. That,
right.
No matter where it is.
And the last thing a bunch of lesbians were going to do is sit there and talk about gay men, right? But
right. And I mean, you're right. And I feel like this comes up a lot when we talk about, you know, women having the right to kind of define their own membership, which is what happened in the case of Vancouver Rape Relief and their fight against Kimberly Nixon, was that in the end, they won the right to define their own membership and their collective as an oppressed class of people. So, you know, there's a difference between the men's spaces that were keeping women out, you know, in the past throughout history, which were spaces of power and spaces where men were getting opportunities and resources, as you say, that women were being excluded from, which, you know, prevented them from living autonomous lives and prevented them from existing as equals in society. The other part that interested me a little bit was the states should recognize that medical research, which is aimed at enabling men to gestate and give birth to children, is a violation of the physical and reproductive integrity of girls and women and is to be eliminated as a form of sex-based discrimination. I wonder if one of you can talk a bit more about that. Why is, I mean, as far as I'm aware, men are not able to gestate as of yet. But, you know, I mean, I guess there's attempts to move in that direction, which is probably obviously creepy to a lot of people, but maybe not to others. So maybe you might be able to explain why it is that this is a bad idea, and particularly with regard to the physical and reproductive integrity of girls and women's. How does this impose on women's rights?
Well, my first thought is, where are they going to get these uteri that they think they're going to implant into men? They're going to get them from women, you know? And so, I mean, I would, that would be my first thought. And the second thought, this is not an article that I'm really sure where they were coming from with, but I do know that especially this whole new idea where you can feed men a whole cocktail of hormones so that they can produce some kind of liquid out of their nipples and then feed it to a child. This is totally untested. And I think that's partly where it must be coming from, is that where are these uteri going to come from if you're going to do this? It's not that, you know, we want to hog all of the childbearing to ourselves, but where is all this going to come from? And already I've seen online these different women who identify as men saying, oh, they can have my uterus, I don't need it. But the thing is, for me, with things that have to do with our physical bodies, these are not standalone systems. I mean, our uteri do something for us besides, you know, provide a place where we might grow a child if we wanted to, for example. You know, you don't, all of our systems are integrated. So, I mean, I don't want to give too much TMI or anything, but I mean, I already had a hip issue, and then when I medically had to have a hysterectomy, it caused more of a problem with my hip, for example. And so when I went, it took a chiropractor to explain to me that there are ligaments that go from the uterus to the pelvis, and that you lose some pelvic stability by losing your uterus, for example. So the idea that we're like Mr. Potato Head people, and girls who identify as boys can just have their uterus taken out and put into a man or something, This is not a healthy way to proceed for women or men, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know people have a really dehumanizing way of thinking about the human body. Like you say, that we're Mr. Potato Heads and you can just take one piece off and put it somewhere else and it won't have any impact on the body as a whole.
Right.
But the other question that I was interested in, I was curious to know what you thought about this Amy Stevens case. So, you know, Amy Stevens is the male who, I guess, decided that he wanted to transition, and he told his employer, and the employer fired Amy. And then Amy sued the employer for sex discrimination and won. And I guess it was a bit of a controversial case because I think that he sued on the basis of sex discrimination. Yeah, it was, you know, it was arguing that this dismissal was discrimination on the basis of Stevens's sex. And I wonder, first of all, if you have an opinion on this case, but also an opinion on those who say, oh, well, this would protect women also, you know, it would protect butch lesbians, or it would protect gender nonconforming women from being fired or discriminated against if they don't conform to femininity.
Do you want to take that one, Lauren? Or I have some things to say, but I think you probably know more than I do.
Well, let's go in tandem. Let's...
You go first.
Okay.
I think, yeah, you go first. Yeah.
I think the main problem with that case is that the court made transgender a thing. It recognized, it legitimized transgender identity. And that's a problem. That is the recognition of transgender, of gender identity, basically erodes women's rights, women's sex-based rights. And so that's the issue. It should have been decided on the basis of Price Waterhouse against Hopkins, the 1989 mm-hmm. case. It should have been decided on that basis, in my opinion. And then it would have protected everybody.
Right. I think the issue was the funeral. He worked for a funeral home, and they had a dress code for women and men. and he wanted to wear, he wanted to wear the dress code for women. And they said they didn't want to have him do that. And so the thing that the court decided was that he was actually a woman. And so he should have been able to wear, he was discriminated against because he should have been able to wear the women's thing, the women's clothing, or follow the women's dress code. That's the way I understood the case. So it's kind of like he wasn't asking for, like as in Price Waterhouse, that someone could be gender nonconforming, you know, that a woman could not enact femininity or a man could not enact. He was for the feminine stereotypes. He just wanted to be recognized as a woman. Mm-hmm. Is that right, Lauren?
Yes, that's right. There's another piece to it, too, which is that that the funeral home, Harris Funeral Home, claimed the right to, you know, for certain jobs to be male and certain jobs to be female. And that was thrown out.
Hmm. So do you think that the decision do you think that the decision hurt women's rights?
Yeah,
because it recognized him as a woman. If the decision had been, you know, that people should not have to wear gender conforming clothing, mm-hmm. that, you know, as the Wolf women had said, the Women's Liberation Front, that would be a good thing. But if the decision is, no, you have to recognize him as a woman, and then he gets to wear the, he gets to follow the women's dress code, that's a problem because mm-hmm. you're recognizing a man as a woman.
Right. So the argument is that he gets to wear the feminine clothes, the women's dress code, because he literally is a woman, not because he's a gender nonconforming male.
Correct. Right. And so if the women say the women didn't want to follow the women's dress code, no, that's not what the case decided. That would have been a case that I think Lauren and Wolf and I would have agreed with, you know, that why should women have to wear the skirt if they don't want to wear a skirt? I don't know what their dress code was exactly. But, you know, we would have supported, you know, not having to wear sex stereotyped clothes. That's mm-hmm. what we would have supported. But that's not what the case argued. What the man argued was that he should be recognized as a woman.
Right. Okay. Awesome. Thank you for clarifying that. I think there's been a lot of confusion around that case. I wanted to talk about the Democratic Party and their role in all of this. So I understand that Joe Biden's campaign talks about him prioritizing allowing men access to women's shelters, women's homeless shelters, to compete in women's sports, to be housed in women's prisons, and that he actually went so far as to say that this access to women's spaces is the civil rights issue of our time. Mm-hmm. I mean, what? Why is the Democratic Party so invested in this issue, apparently?
I punt to Lauren. Well, Lauren, you may want to say first that we can't represent any political stance for the Women's Human Rights Campaign.
Thank you for the reminder. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I can only guess, but my best guess is follow the money, and there are probably some huge donors to the Democratic Party who are transgender, you know, transgender identified males themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, this started really with Obama, didn't it? Don't you think, Lauren? Because mm-hmm. The Pritzker family are big patrons of Barack Obama. Because remember at the end of his term, he wrote that Dear Colleague letter, his administration sent out the Dear Colleague letter that said the thing about how children should be able to use the restroom they identify with in schools and all of that. But he's from Chicago. The Pritzkers are Chicago-based. The governor of Illinois right now is J.B. Pritzker. He's cousin to Jenny Pritzker, who it was formerly James Pritzker. And also Penny Pritzker was I forget what her role was in the Obama administration. But these are very wealthy people who were patrons this is a very, very wealthy family that were patrons of Barack Obama. So I know it started at least back then, if not earlier.
And what's the plan? I mean, what is what are your plans in terms of activism around the women's human rights campaign in the U.S.? Are you trying to reach politicians? Are you trying to, you know, reach members of the Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, the sort of the mission of the Women's Human Rights Campaign is to advocate for law and public policy, advocate for women's sex-based rights in law and public policy. So yes. And in fact, we did, when we did our launch about a week or two ago, was it, Lauren?
Yeah, 17.
We sent letters to every Democratic senator urging them to revise the Equality Act, because it does look as though the Democrats may retake the Senate. If they retake the Senate, then they could possibly pass the Equality Act. So we did do that. Another one of our big projects we're just starting, because we've really only been together about a few months, haven't we, Lauren? About three
That's
months
right.
or so.
Yes.
And so our other project that we're starting, once we finished our launch, our other project we started was we're going to be building a network of contacts in all 50 states. So that we can know what's going on legislatively in all the states, we can have our ear to the ground, but also we can have a network of people ready to act when Lauren's going to be writing her amendment to the Equality Act. So that's one of our big pieces. But we're also working with coalitions on the sports issue, and also the ROGD Ohio. When that bill comes to the floor, it's in committee right now. That is a bill to ban pediatric transition. And so we're basically right now.
Can you just clarify what pediatric transition means for people listening who might not be familiar with the term?
Well, transitioning children with drugs and, you know, puberty, what they euphemistically call puberty blockers, but Lupron is a very dangerous drug, and cross-sex hormones and all of that kind of thing.
And is there an age limit there? Like, what defines it as pediatric transition?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure where it ends, okay, because we haven't really taken that one up yet. That bill is kind of stuck in committee in Ohio.
Okay.
And so it hasn't come to the floor. So we're still learning. The thing with the U.S. is it's so huge and there's so much going on in all the different states. That's why we wanted to build this big network, so we could have contacts in every state and we could stay abreast of what's going on. It's very hard to keep up, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of different things. Connecticut, there's also the sports issue, the Idaho sports issue. We are going to be involved with that as well. I don't know if you know, the Idaho legislature had passed a bill saying that boys who identify as girls cannot compete against girls in girls' sports. And then the ACLU brought a lawsuit against that. And recently there was a temporary injunction saying that they could not implement the law while this case was going on. Is that correct, Lauren? I want to make sure I have all the facts right.
That's correct. They brought the case, the ACLU brought the case in federal court. So it's the federal government that's coming down on the state of Idaho.
Right, exactly. And so there are many, many different fronts to work on. And so that's why we're trying to educate with our YouTube series that I just described to you about each part of the declaration and connecting it to a piece of legislation, and also in what activists can do about it, and building our network, and then working on the amendment to the Equality Act. Because my fear is that the Equality Act, I don't know what you think about this. Lauren has a background in law, and that's why I asked her, but do you think, you know, I asked this of Kara Danski today, do you think the Equality Act could supersede, for example, Title IX? If the Equality Act is passed, does that mean that Title IX is basically negated?
Yes, because gender identity trumps sex. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Title IX is gone. Title VII right. is gone.
Really scary.
Yeah, it is. It is, but I feel kind of excited because I feel like we have like a really hardworking, motivated group. Don't you feel that way, Lauren? I mean, it's very, yes. Right now it's small and we're going to grow slowly, the activist portion of it. I mean, we have a larger group that, you know, engages in various things, but the core group is relatively small, but very, very motivated, very hardworking, very intelligent. And so I'm feeling kind of positive.
It's true. It's a great bunch. I feel a little frustrated by the pandemic circumstances. I really wish we could just all get together in person and chill and talk and have wonderful conversations, because I think we'd have wonderful conversations. And at some point, I think we will, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the pandemic's been tough in terms of the activism that we've all been trying to do around gender identity, because we can't have events and we can't get together, and it makes it hard to organize and galvanize, although obviously women are still doing the most they can. And I've been happy to see that finally in Canada there are groups organizing around this issue, because we've been sort of slow in the uptake.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, I mean, before we all sign off, what is there anything else that you wanted to add around the declaration, around the activism that you're doing here, what's happening in the U.S., that you feel is important?
I have something. I really think the most important part of this, aside from the free speech issue, which may be the most important piece of all, but just below that is the language problem that we're having. The language is being co-opted and it's being enforced. I mean, we're being coerced in the courts are coercing people not to quote unquote misgender parties to the lawsuit or lawyers or whatever, and that's a big problem, because in order even to talk about women's sex-based rights, we really need to take this trans language, right? And and we need to walk it back through the looking glass, right? To a place where words have meaning again, and meaning that's understood by everybody. Because you really can't even talk about sex-based rights if all you've got to talk about them is sex-blind language.
Mm-hmm. That's something we're really committed to in all the letters that we've been writing and the public comments on various government policies and so on that we've been writing. We're very, very committed to that, you know, to taking back our language. What I would want to say is to encourage people who listen to your show to go to womensdeclaration.com to read the declaration. I mean, I was just so blown away the first time I read it. It's very well written, very straightforward, grounded, like, as I said, in international treaty and convention. Read it, sign it. Once you sign it, you're going to find that you will receive an email to, you know, and then if you want to remain on the email list, you can be involved in various things that we're doing. And check out our YouTube channel. We're just getting that going. We have a few great videos on there already. One of our youngest members, she made some great animated shorts. One's called I Just Want to Pee, about the whole bathroom thing in the schools. Mm-hmm. And what was her other one, Lauren? Oh, yeah, This Never Happens, about all the trans crime. And then there's a great interview with Lauren that my co-chair, Vajra Ma, did with Lauren, who we're talking to now. And then we're going to start, as I said, by Friday, I should have the interview with Lauren, with Kara Dansky on Article 1. That should be up on Friday. And then periodically, I'm going to, every sort of week, 10 days, I'll have a new video up on each article of the Declaration. And as I say, each of those videos is going to connect to a specific law or public policy, and also finish with what can we do? What is an action item out of that?
Excellent. Thank you so much for all of that info. I'm so glad that this declaration exists and that there's sort of a place to say, I mean, I get a lot of emails from women all the time asking, you know, how can they get involved and what can they do? And there hasn't always been somewhere to send them. You know, there's not been one place where they could sort of go for the information and to try to get involved in doing some kind of activism. I mean, apart from, you know, starting your own group, which is also a great thing to do, and doing your own activism or lobbying politicians or starting a book club or organizing an event or whatever. But I agree that the declaration is really well written, and I was very impressed by it also. And so I'm glad there's a chapter starting up in the US. I know that there are some women in Canada talking about starting up a chapter also, so I'm really excited about that. And it was really great to talk with you both. I'm really grateful for your time.
Thank you so
much. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Yeah, we really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks so much, Megan.
You just heard an interview with Catherine Acosta and Lauren Levy. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.